Wisconsin's Corrections Department has put together an expansive plan to reduce its use of isolation and shorter stays for inmates in solitary confinement. That's according to a report filed yesterday by attorneys representing the state in a federal class action lawsuit filed by current and former inmates. We're discussing solitary confinement on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Human Rights Court has referred to it as being imprisoned within the prison, locking up an inmate for 22 hours or more a day without meaningful contact. Psychiatrist Terry Ellen Coopers is professor emeritus at the Wright Institute Graduate School of Psychology. His new book is Solitary, the Inside Story of Supermax Isolation and How We Can Abolish It. Dr. Coopers, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Well, this practice of isolating a prisoner, it's not new at all. When did it first start? When did we start to see solitary confinement take hold in American prisons?
Well, we have a long history of solitary confinement. Benjamin Franklin advocated it at the Walnut Street Jail in Philadelphia. And the idea was to put the criminal alone in a room and let him be penitent. That's where the word penitentiary comes from. And maybe get over his criminal ways and return to society. It quickly failed, and that the reason was because the jail became overcrowded. Instead of having one person in a room, they put two or three, and what Benjamin Franklin had advocated was having the warden come and talk to each prisoner each day and ask how their penitence was going. That soon ended, and the jails became just warehouses for people in solitary confinement, and immediately they discovered there was a lot of psychological damage. People just went crazy in solitary, idle with nothing to do and no social contact.
You said in your book that solitary confinement is used way more than the numbers reveal in America. How widespread has the use of solitary become here in the U.S.?
Well, the United States puts more people in prison than any other country in the world per capita. And in the prison, solitary confinement is more widely used. Estimates are that there's 100,000 people officially in solitary confinement. That is, they're consigned to their cell nearly 24 hours a day and almost entirely idle. Actually, there's a lot more, because unofficially, a lot of people are just locked in their cells in what's called keep lock or lockdown, and there's probably half as many, again, people in that kind of isolation where they don't even get out for exercise. And there are many other situations, for instance, in our jails, where people spend the time alone in a cell with nothing to do.
Is solitary confinement unique to U.S. prisons, or do we see this around the globe?
Well, there's some form of solitary in a lot of countries, but basically, for instance, the European and Scandinavian countries do not put nearly as many people as we do in prison. And the prisons aren't crowding. It's really crowding that caused the authorities to turn to solitary confinement. In the 80s, the prisons were just entirely out of control. They were violent. No one was doing any rehabilitation. The rehabilitation was being cut back because of a fear of coddling prisoners. So solitary became the way to handle the unmanageable prison. It's what I call a historic wrong turn, because the better way would have been to reduce the prison population to a manageable number, for instance, by stopping the war on drugs and by sentencing reform, and to reinstate rehabilitation. We didn't do that. All of the other countries do, and Europe in particular, Scandinavia, Japan, even China, puts far fewer people in prison. They have far less difficulty controlling the prisons, and therefore they don't resort to solitary confinement.
Over your decades of research in investigating prisons, you've seen a number of prisons inside, toured inside these supermax facilities. Does solitary confinement vary from prison to prison, or are there some common characteristics that you have seen across the board?
Well, I see the characteristic across the board of keeping someone in a cell 22, 23, even 24 hours a day. They are given a minimum of exercise, usually in a little cage-like enclosure. And that's common, that's in common in all of the states and the federal government. Now, there are differences. Some of the cells are larger, some smaller. Some have bars on the door. Some are solid metal doors, which increases the isolation. Some cells have windows to the outside. Usually they don't open. Some do not. So if you're in a cell with a solid metal door and no window, it's much worse conditions than if you have a window and bars on your door. Some solitary confinement units permit visiting, some do not. Some permit phone calls, some do not. The more isolation, the worse the damaging psychological effects.
What about temperature in the cell? What about access to a bathroom?
Well, in prison, the bathroom is basically right by your head as you sleep. There's a bed, a very thin bed, usually built into the floor or the wall. And then there's a toilet sink metal device that's usually right by your head. And so you don't need to go out of the cell to go to the bathroom. The temperature varies, and it depends on the temperature of the locale and also how ventilated or heated the facility. In a lot of prisons, the solitary units are extremely cold in the winter and very hot and humid in the summer. And I know that's true in Wisconsin, so that a federal judge ordered the Wisconsin Department of Corrections to put in air conditioning because the summers were so intolerable.
We're talking right now with Dr. Terry Ellen Coopers. He is a psychiatrist and professor emeritus at the Wright Institute Graduate School of Psychology. His new book is titled Solitary, The Inside Story of Supermax Isolation and How We Can Abolish It. You can join in this conversation at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about the use of solitary confinement in American prisons? Do you think it's a practice that needed to keep the peace, or does it do more harm than good? Have you or someone you know been in solitary confinement? What was the experience like? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dr. Coopers, generally, what has been the argument in favor of keeping solitary confinement as, quote unquote, a tool in the toolbox for keeping order in prisons?
Well, that, of course, is the idea, and that is that prison authorities say we need solitary to secure the prison and make it operate smoothly. Actually, there's not a shred of evidence supporting that. There's no research showing that there's a decrease in violence in the prisons, nor in gang activity. And what happens is that people are broken in solitary. The psychological damage is so great that when they come out, they're actually less inclined to follow the rules and less able to initiate any productive activity. And then the prison becomes more unmanageable. Meanwhile, there's a lot of damage, both in stable people and people with mental illness. So it really, we get nothing by putting people in solitary. The other thing is that there's an awful lot of abuse in solitary. Once you've punished someone to the extent of putting them in solitary confinement, people act out when they're in solitary. One of the symptoms we find around the country is mounting anger. That the prisoners will tell me, it's irrational, I don't know why I'm getting so angry. But the anger mounts, and they're terrified that they're going to get into trouble because of getting angry at an officer or something like that. So they become even more unmanageable, and their social skills are deteriorating.
And you are a psychiatrist. From your perspective, what is happening in solitary to the human brain as someone who is in solitary confinement, perhaps days, weeks, maybe months?
Well, we don't actually know in any individual case when a person is going to suffer the most damage. Some people fall apart entirely within days. Some people tolerate the isolation for a month or two and then fall apart. And when I say fall fall apart, I mean, they become extremely anxious. They might become paranoid. They start pacing. They clean their cell over and over again. They despair of ever getting out of solitary. They feel that they're never going to get out and they're going to die there. And the rate of suicide is very high. Now, for some people, terrible things happen in days, and for some people, it takes months, but everyone is damaged. And then people with mental illness who are selectively consigned to solitary confinement, usually, I mean, they're not famous for following rules and being polite, so they get in trouble with staff, they get sent to solitary, and it exacerbates their mental illness. Whatever they suffer from, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, they have severe acute psychotic episodes or manic attacks or depressive episodes. And we know around the country that solitary exacerbates the mental illness greatly.
So what does that mean when the prisoner is released, where they have gone from being completely isolated at some point in their prison sentence to being released, surrounded by people, you know, on the outside to be free?
Well, the person with serious mental illness is going to come out of solitary with a much worse mental illness. So whether they're hallucinating or they're despairing and suicidal or whatever the symptoms tend to be of their mental illness, they're going to be much worse. They're going to be more difficult to treat. Their prognosis is going to be harmed a great deal. Now, for everyone else, what I'm worried about is what I call the SHU post-release syndrome. SHU is the acronym in California, Security Housing Unit, and nationally has become an acronym describing supermax solitary confinement. What happens when people get out of solitary who are relatively stable? If they have a serious mental illness, that's going to be the most obvious and disabling problem. But if they don't suffer from a serious mental illness, they're going to feel cut off from their feelings. They're going to feel numb, and they're going to tend to isolate themselves. As paradoxical as that seems, they've been forced into isolation for months, sometimes years or decades. When they get out, they set up an isolation system of their own. So if they get out and go to the general population area of the prison, they will tend to stay in their cell or stay very close to their cell. They'll be very hesitant to mix with other people, especially people they don't know. They'll be very anxious. They won't be able to concentrate. And this is what I call the SHU post-release syndrome. When they go home and a certain number of people do what we call max out of the SHU. That is, their prison sentence ends while they're in solitary, and they're released to the community. I find these people, for instance, a mother will call me and say, what am I supposed to do with my son? He came home and he stays in his room. He won't even come to the dining room for dinner. And it's a very widespread phenomenon. So more serious, I think, and affecting more people than the serious mental illness that's made worse, is this tendency to be numb and to isolate oneself, which makes the ex-prisoner very dysfunctional.
Solitary confinement, it's been used to detain potentially dangerous prisoners or to protect those who are at risk of being harmed, either by themselves or by others. But the practice, it can infringe on human rights. And we're learning about the consequences of solitary this hour with Dr. Terry Ellen Coopers. He has investigated prison conditions for more than 40 years. His new book is Solitary, the Inside Story of Supermax Isolation and How We Can Abolish It. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about the use of solitary confinement in American prisons? Do you think it's a practice that is needed to keep the peace, or does it do more harm than good? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll be back in just a moment on the Ideas Network. Prisoners can be placed in isolation for many reasons, from serious infractions such as fighting with another inmate to minor ones like talking back to a guard or getting caught with a pack of cigarettes or contraband. Other times, prisoners are put in solitary for not breaking any rules at all. Prisons have been using solitary confinement as a tool to manage gangs, isolating people for simply talking to a suspected gang member. We're learning about the impact of having tens of thousands of people in solitary. Dr. Terry Ellen Cooper stays with us. He's a psychiatrist and professor emeritus at the Wright Institute Graduate School of Psychology. His new book is titled Solitary, the Inside Story of Supermax Isolation and How We Can Abolish It. You can join in this conversation as well at 800-642-1234. Let's go directly to the phones with Anne in Milwaukee. Hi, Anne. Go ahead.
Hello. Hi. I'm a psychologist at a treatment facility for civilly committed sex offenders, and we as well employ solitary confinement for individuals who have broken minor rules as well as larger rules. And what we have seen, or at least what I have seen, is that, you know, you're taking away any of these individuals' positive coping mechanisms, such as like vocational or recreational or even just social interactions, and placing them alone to kind of fall back on their treatment program. And, you know, when you're working with individuals who have had, who have high psychopathy or who have had early childhood experiences of just major fight or flight, you're kind of perpetuating that problem of being alone. And when you take away positive coping, there's very little left for the individual to fall back on, and oftentimes you see them reverse in treatment.
Anne, thank you so much for those observations. Dr. Coopers, what is left beyond solitary? You know, where do you go from solitary?
Well, those were very good points, both that when someone is in solitary, they're not doing any kind of constructive activity. There's no rehabilitation going on. They're basically wasting away. And also, there's a lot of trauma in the background of prisoners. We think that's related to drug use, that a lot of drug use is self-medicating for childhood traumas and other traumas. So it's a very big problem. I think the main issue is we need to decide when we put someone, we being the state, put someone in prison, what is it that we're trying to do? If what we're trying to do is punish them because of vengeance, because we're very angry at them for having done the crime they did, then we're going to do abusive things to them, like beatings. We're going to allow them to be raped. We're going to put them in solitary confinement. We're going to do what are called cell extractions, where they're brutally removed from solitary cells. However, I think the more overriding issue is, and what we should be concerned is, whether what we do to them in prison makes them more or less likely to return to drugs and crime when they get out. That should be our overriding concern. And with that concern in mind, solitary is a very foolhardy procedure, because what it does is it breaks people and it causes what I call the decimation of life skills. They get out of practice having social relations, and when they get out, they have a lot of trouble. Now, if we're going to remove the people who are currently in solitary confinement, they're angry, they're broken, they're out of touch with their feelings, they're not used to having social relations, we have to do some affirmative programs, and I include this in my notion of rehabilitation. We have to treat them with respect. We have to do something to halt their violence. We don't need solitary confinement to keep someone from being violent. For instance, we can separate people who tend to fight from each other. We don't have to isolate them. And then we need to put them in programs. To begin with, social skills programs, help them to learn again how to relate to other people, help them learn to identify their feelings, to manage their anger, to apply themselves to productive activities, again, rehabilitation programs. And we need to do that with a certain amount of supervision. That is, staff have to keep an eye on them and help them with the problems they encounter getting back to meaningful social interactions and productive activities. All of those things need to be put in place. The state of Colorado, in their Department of Corrections, has done away with solitary confinement. And they've just announced that. Rick Ramish, the director, had an op-ed in the New York Times. In order to accomplish that, they had to improve their rehabilitation programs and develop programs for every level of trouble that prisoners get into. So people who have trouble managing their temper, they had to do intensive anger management. People who could not be placed in the same yard or day room together had to be separated. And they worked out alternatives to solitary, which is what makes it possible to end the practice.
Ann, thanks for the call, the observations. Let's go to Rebecca now in Madison. Hi, Rebecca.
Good morning. I had a question. The doctor was talking about outcomes. Is there a difference with solitary confinement long-term outcomes when it's a child in juvenile facilities versus adults? Thank you.
And I know it was difficult to hear Rebecca. She's wondering if solitary confinement rehabilitation is different for children placed in solitary versus adults.
Well, it's a very good question. Solitary is being used more in child facilities, and I'm talking about juvenile facilities around the country, or we have a trend in the United States of trying more and more juveniles as adults. So we have a 14 or a 16-year-old kid who commits, you know, usually a violent crime. They're tried as an adult, and they're sent to an adult prison. What they're going to do, they're going to be attacked. They're basically bait for sexual predators and people who want to rob them and beat them. So in one way or another, they get locked in solitary. We know a lot about the juvenile brain. The teenagers are not fully developed, and they need productive activities, for instance, education, in order to train their mind and become a functional adult. If you take a juvenile and put him with a lot of energy in a solitary cell by himself, he's going to more quickly lose his mind, essentially. He's going to be bouncing off the walls, and it's going to be more damaging. And the damage, both what the solitary confinement does, which is to damage the brain, and then also the activities that are age-appropriate that he or she needs in order to grow into a productive citizen. We have an epidemic around the country of juveniles in solitary confinement. In juvenile facilities, even in schools, solitary is used as a last resort by just frustrated staff who don't know what to do with them. We have to learn what to do with them, because eventually they're going to grow into adults and come out of whatever institution they're in. And it's much more important to train them to be productive citizens than to punish them with long terms in solitary confinement. New York, Rikers Island, there was a lawsuit, and it is now not acceptable to put juveniles in solitary. And in fact, after that lawsuit was settled, the violence rate among the juveniles at Rikers Island went down. They didn't become more violent because they were not in solitary. Instead, they became more functional and participated in programs.
And Lucas would like to join us and to discuss just that. Lucas in Superior, go ahead.
Hey, I'm a formerly incarcerated person with ex-prisoners.org, and you were talking about the way out, like the land beyond this, beyond the solitary confinement. There's trying to be a way out. A couple years ago, there was actually prison strikes around the state and around the country, actually, just against solitary confinement and everything. And I actually been writing to a lot of people in Bosco Bell and Dodge and everything, about the conditions, about how they're going essentially crazy. And I hope people of Wisconsin and the DOC realizing that a lot of their money is being wasted on these concrete caskets and everything like that. It's a total waste of money. They're almost akin of Gitmo and everything. So, yeah, thank you so much.
And Dr. Cooper's, as Lucas mentioned, the Supermax in Bosco Bell, you've been in there. You wrote about this in your book.
Yes. Actually, I've been in Boscobel. We had a lawsuit there, the Jones L. versus Breggy lawsuit, back in the early part of the 2000s. And the result of that lawsuit is that people with mental illness are no longer permitted to be consigned to solitary confinement at Boscobel.
So are prisoners around the country reacting to solitary in ways of banding together, in some way, as Lucas said, protesting solitary confinement? What are prisoners doing about it?
Yes. Let me just add one other issue that I think is very important, and that's race. Solitary confinement is used along racial lines. The racism of our society is reflected in dynamics in prison, so that people of color, African American, Latino, are selectively sent to solitary confinement more than other people. And they then protest that. They say, I'm being consigned to solitary because of my race, or I'm being abused by officers because of my race. A hunger strike is sort of the last thing that prisoners can do to demand their rights. And what happens in hunger strikes, we had a series of hunger strikes between 2011 and 2014 in California at Pelican Bay State Prison, which is a solitary, it's a prison that specializes in solitary confinement, so it's a supermax prison. And the prisoners made five demands. One demand was that they have meaningful exercise. Another demand is they have some things in their cell which foster intellectual pursuits, for instance, books. Very, very simple demands, that they have more visiting. At Pelican Bay, they were not able to receive phone calls, and they were demanding phone calls. Well, they complain through the prison's complaint system or grievance system, and they get no recourse from that. And then as a last-ditch stand, they do a hunger strike, which doesn't harm anybody. It's an expression of their First Amendment rights to free speech. But what happens is the prison authorities then punish them even more. They put them in a more extreme form of isolation. They take away their bedding. They take away their clothes and punish them even more harshly for expressing their First Amendment rights. Generally, when there's a hunger strike, I want to talk to the prisoners and find out, what are your complaints and what's the purpose of the hunger strike? I mean, they're starving themselves. They're not hurting anyone.
Well, Dr. Lucas, Coopers, I mean, prisons are up against budget issues here. Wouldn't pursuing a more rehabilitative approach, wouldn't that cost more and also be an issue impeding, using solitary?
Well, nothing costs more than solitary confinement. Estimates are $75,000 to $100,000 a year per prisoner in solitary confinement. It's the most expensive form of imprisonment there is. What's needed is there needs to be a little bit of money. I mean, think about why we have, for instance, a very high proportion of prisoners suffer from serious mental illness. And it has to do, I believe, they're being disappeared into the jails and prisons, because out in the community, we've been defunding the public mental health services, the housing support, and such. And so we've disappeared people into the prison who are suffering from mental illness. There are 10 times as many people in our jails and prisons as there are in our psychiatric hospitals. Well, this disappearing of the people that are harmed by public sector budget cuts, by an end to the social safety net, they then go to prison. And yes, I insist that they need some services, for instance, mental health treatment. They also need rehabilitation services. That will cost a little bit of money, relatively little compared to the cost of locking them up in solitary, and relatively little compared to what it'll cost the state when they become very damaged by solitary and then for the rest of their life need more intensive services just to stay afloat. So there can be a bit of an expense up front. And when we settle lawsuits, what the state usually agrees to is to supply better quality mental health care to people with serious mental illness. There's a cost to that, and they have to go to the legislature and get that funded. But then in a slightly longer range view, there's a decreased cost because there's less need for solitary, and because the people who they program that way are more functional and need less supervision in the long run.
Lucas, thanks for calling in with your story there. Carol now in Milwaukee. Go ahead, Carol.
I agree with the doctor that the question of punishment is a very key question. And if they do have to use solitary confinement, the guards could tell the prisoner, instead of saying this is your punishment and making him angry, they could tell him, well, you've been doing these things and we just don't know how to control you, and you're just going to have to spend a little time in here until you get yourself under control, something like that, rather than putting it in terms of punishment. Everything is a punishment. They should, and the person will not become as angry if they see the realistic reason for it.
You know, that's a very good point. The problem that I see with that is that the relationships between staff and prisoners deteriorate in solitary confinement. So in your comment, you're assuming an officer who is concerned about the prisoner and trying to help them and is having a reasonable discussion. Think about a solitary confinement unit. There's a slot in the door. It's usually below waist level, through which a food tray is passed. An officer comes by and passes a food tray to the prisoner. It might be a solid metal door. There's no conversation. There's no relationship between the two. Often there's cussing both ways. That is, the officer treats the prisoner with no respect, and the prisoner is disrespectful to the officer, and nothing constructive happens. That's an average scenario. I agree with you that staff should be interacting with prisoners in a mutually respectful way and encouraging them to gain the skill to control their behavior, to stay out of trouble, and to gain the skills they'll need when they get out of prison. They should be helping them to have a view of themselves as a future productive citizen out in the community. It doesn't happen in solitary. One hopes it happens in rehabilitation programs in general population, but there's something about solitary confinement which makes the staff-prisoner relationships deteriorate, and then there's very frequent abuse. And the more these places are secret in the sense the press doesn't get in to see them, people aren't, if they don't have phone calls, they're not even able to talk to their family. So what goes on in solitary confinement is entirely secret. And in that situation where one group of people, the officers, have total control over another, the prisoners, abuses just become rampant. And there's beatings, there's sexual assaults, there's unnecessary use of pepper spray. And so if what you were describing was the usual situation, I think we'd have much less need for solitary confinement.
Carol, thanks for the call. It's not unusual for inmates to spend months, even years at a time in solitary confinement in this day and age, despite the fact that some states have attempted to put constraints on how prisons use solitary. Supporters say the practice helps keep prisons safe. But according to the medical literature, solitary confinement can also take a really heavy mental toll. Psychological effects like visual and auditory hallucinations, sensitivity to noise and touch, insomnia, paranoia, increased risk for suicide. Dr. Terry Ellen Coopers has investigated prison conditions for more than 40 years. He stays with us. His new book is Solitary, The Inside Story of Supermax Isolation and How We Can Abolish It. You can come into this discussion about solitary and supermax prisons at 800-642-1234. Do you think solitary is the way forward for keeping prisons safe? Should solitary be outlawed, or is another tool in the toolbox to maintain order in prisons? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll be back in just a moment on the Ideas Network. Coming up next on Point, what we're learning about the New York terror attack and asking the tough questions, including, do we have to accept life with soft target attacks? That's after 9 on Point. Since the 1990s, the UN Committee Against Torture has repeatedly condemned the use of solitary confinement in the U.S. Politicians and other public figures, such as President Obama, Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy, and Pope Francis, have denounced long-term solitary confinement, while the U.S. Senate has called for reforms from the U.S. Bureau of Prisons. We're discussing the state of solitary confinement with Dr. Terry Ellen Coopers. His new book is Solitary. He is a professor emeritus at the Wright Institute Graduate School of Psychology, and he's fielding your questions on solitary confinement at 800-642-1234. Do you think it's keeping the peace or doing more harm than good? Have you or a loved one been in solitary confinement? Join in the discussion at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Tim now in Whitewater. Hi, Tim. Go ahead.
Hey, thank you. Good discussion. It's time we have this kind of discussion. I've got one comment and then a question. Comment is I hear things like $100,000 a year for solitary confinement thrown around. I always question that. You know, where does a number like that seems unfathomable to me. You don't need to touch on that if you want, but when somebody throws around a question like that, I kind of question a certain amount of its validity. And my question then is, would you agree, would your guest agree that there are some cases where, I get the tone of this that, you know, everybody's fixable, for lack of better terms, that that we can solve all this. And my sense is that there are just some people that you can't fine-tune and get back into society. So what do we do with them? I'm not saying solitary confinement is the place for them. But, you know, the tone of this is always, well, you know, prisoners have rights. Well, they did something to get there. What about the law and the guards and the law enforcement people that are putting their lives at risk trying to manage these situations? They have families, too.
Dr. Coopers.
Well, I think it's a good point. I have looked, and I've probably interviewed 1,000 prisoners in solitary confinement. I've never met a prisoner I cannot be in a room with alone, without officers, for instance. It's just not true that there are people who are chronically troublemakers. Actually, prisoners are a very ordinary population. There's some bright prisoners, there's some not so bright prisoners, just like people in the community. And they have a range of educational backgrounds, they have a range of talents and capabilities. What we've done is we've put a large population of prisoners into solitary confinement and broken them so that they become less capable of meaningful social relations, and then they get into an increasing amount of trouble. Again, what we need to think about is whether what we do to these people makes them more or less likely to return to drugs and crime when they get through with their prison experience or their solitary confinement. And I can promise that if you have someone who's a
hello, Dr. Coopers, are you there?
Voicemail.
Oh, dear, we just lost Dr. Coopers there for a moment here as we have this discussion on solitary confinement. And you can join in the discussion at 800-642-1234. How have you seen solitary confinement working in Wisconsin? Here in Wisconsin, one of the biggest corrections issues has been the ongoing situation at the state's youth prison, which has been under a criminal investigation for nearly 3 years for inmate abuse and child neglect. And in response to that, Nevada federal judge ruled over the summer that officials at the prison must significantly curb the use of solitary confinement. And now teens there can only be in solitary for a maximum of 7 consecutive days, down from 60 days. Since then, there have been numerous assaults on staff at the facility, including a recent incident where inmates climbed onto the roof, threw shingles at guards, and allegedly chanted, "We are only going to get 7 days for this." So now staff members at Lincoln Hill say they need solitary to get inmates under control. What do you feel about solitary confinement? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dr. Coopers, are you back with us?
Yes, I am.
Very good. Well, and I was describing a situation in Wisconsin at its youth prison, which is under a criminal investigation and must curb its use of solitary confinement and pepper spray and shackles. There have been incidents now where inmates have revolted. They have threw shingles at guards saying, now staff members, you know, now we're only going to get 7 days for this. And so what would you advise in a situation like this?
You know, I have had this discussion with commissioners of correction, people who lead departments of correction around the country, and we've discussed doing away with solitary confinement. The time span that keeps coming up is 14 days. The special rapporteur of the United Nations said anything more than 14 days in solitary is a human rights abuse or torture. And the commissioners will say, we often have situations where the prison is out of control and we have to lock people down in order to gain control back of the prison. And I will grant them that. I think there are other ways to do that, and they should try every less restrictive way first. But then to put someone in solitary for several days while you're trying to decide what to do with them, that is not as onerous as putting them in indefinite, indeterminate solitary confinement. So I don't argue about that, and I have not argued about a less than 14-day period in solitary. That's generally not considered long-term solitary confinement. The United Nations has published new rules in order to avoid torture. They're called the Mandela rules, after Nelson Mandela. And 14 days is the limit of solitary under United Nations standards.
Let's go to Ben now in Madison. Hi, Ben. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I didn't hear that.
Oh, Ben, are you there? Oh, I guess we don't have Ben. Let's go to Pepin in Milwaukee. Hi, Pepin. Go ahead.
Hi. I actually watched a video online that said that after 3 days of solitary confinement, you can actually kind of see damage occurring in the brain. And I'm just wondering if your guest could verify whether or not I'm mistaken about that.
I think about that a great deal, and I agree with you that it can happen within days. When I said 14 days, that's a negotiation. We're settling a lawsuit, and the 14 days is better than 3 months. But I agree with you, the damage can happen in 3 days. The problem is that the staff really doesn't know the damage is going on. And the reason is, for instance, there are what are called cell front interviews in solitary confinement. The mental health staff should be providing prisoners with an assessment. When someone goes to solitary, they should have a thorough assessment to decide whether they can handle the isolation even for a few days. But those assessments have to happen in a private space, for instance, an office on the pod, in order for there to be privacy and confidentiality. In most prisons, there's not enough officers to move the prisoner who needs evaluation to an office, so the psychologist or psychiatrist comes to the front of the prisoner's cell. So imagine this. He's talking to a prisoner and asking him if he hears voices or if he's suicidal within earshot of prisoners in neighboring cells and staff walking by. I think that's an ethical violation for the mental health staff. But what happens is the prisoner, because there's a lot of stigma on being weak or having a mental illness, the prisoner will refuse to talk to the person doing the evaluation. Usually the prisoner will walk to the opposite side of the cell and face the wall until the psychologist or psychiatrist goes away. So there's going to be a false negative. That is, the psychologist or the psychiatrist is not going to find out that the person is deteriorating mentally, and then he'll be left in solitary where he'll deteriorate further. So that put that perspective back into your question. Yes, people fall apart within 3 days, and they should have a thorough assessment both when they go into solitary and on a regular basis to catch the ones who are falling apart and help them. But that's very difficult to do once solitary confinement has been effected.
Pepin, thank you so much for that question. And that explores a little area that I'm curious about, Dr. Coopers. I was under the notion that solitary can be this knee-jerk reaction, that a prisoner can go to solitary pretty quickly after whatever infraction has just happened. But you're saying that there is an assessment process, that there are steps to get to solitary.
What were the last words?
But you're saying that there must be more of a thorough assessment happening, and there are stages or steps to get to solitary confinement, that it's not just a knee-jerk reaction from a guard.
Well, unfortunately, it often is a knee-jerk, so both occur,
okay.
But that's correct. There, you know, solitary confinement, like everything else in prison, can be done right and it can be done wrong. Some staff talk very respectfully to prisoners and say, look, I have to put you in a solitary cell because you violated a rule, but I'm going to come and talk to you, and I want to know what your plan is to get out of here and how you're going to solve your problem with that person you got in a fight with. That would be a respectful interaction. The problem is that the environment of solitary confinement works on the staff as well as the prisoners. So the staff in solitary is less and less likely to be respectful towards the prisoners, and therefore they can't solve the problems in a healthy, growthful way. Rather, they just heap one punishment on top of another. They do things like cell extractions. If the prisoner doesn't cooperate with a order, they will get a group of officers, 5 or 6 of them, in riot gear with face masks and gas masks, and they'll pepper spray the prisoner, and they'll rush him in his cell. They'll open the cell door and rush in, and usually the prisoner is beat up pretty bad in this procedure. Well, that procedure is widespread in solitary confinement, and the reason is because the environment causes the deterioration of the relationships between staff and prisoners, and therefore an excessive amount of force is used to subdue the prisoners, rather than having the kind of conversation you're assuming, where the staff talk to the prisoner and encourage them to behave in a different way, which almost always gets a good result.
As we wrap up here in the last few seconds, do you see an end in sight for solitary confinement?
Is there a place for it?
Do you see it ending across the U.S., or do you see it staying as a tool for keeping control of prisoners?
I'm very concerned about that. We have been making great progress. It's not just solitary confinement. For instance, we need sentencing reform. We need to reduce the prison population so the staff is able to work with prisoners in a constructive way and help them succeed at going straight. But we have just overcrowded our prisons with the war on drugs, etc. In most states today, including Wisconsin, there is a move towards sentence reform and towards ending solitary confinement. There are laws in many states that you can't put juveniles in solitary confinement.
And we're going to have to leave it right there. I'm sorry. Thank you so much for joining us. Dr. Terry Ellen Coopers is a psychiatrist and professor emeritus at the Wright Institute Graduate School of Psychology. His new book is Solitary, The Inside Story of Supermax Isolation and How We Can Abolish It. This hour, The Morning Show was produced by Chris Molina. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Ideas Network.